May it please the Court, my name is Colleen Shields, and I represent the Oblates of St. Francis de Sales and Salesianum School. I'd like to introduce the Court to my co-counsel, Mark Topko, who has a pro hoc admission, and he will be arguing the constitutional portions. I'll be arguing the evidentiary portions. Thank
Welcome
you.
Welcome to the Court.
May it please the Court, my name is Steve Neuberger, and together with my co-counsel Robert Jacobs and Tom Neuberger, we represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Jimmy Sheehan. Now, the key to understanding the meaning of the proximate cause jury verdict is found in the transcript of the jury prayer conference, which is found in plaintiff's appendix at pages 1165 to 1174. There, Judge Scott analyzed the meaning of the proximate cause instruction and questioned the parties, and ultimately reached a conclusion about what the instruction meant and what the instruction was intended to go to. Plaintiff was consistent on the meaning of the instruction at the prayer conference, stating that it means whether the sexual abuse caused plaintiff's post-traumatic stress disorder, his major depression, and other issues. The transcript does reveal confusion at the prayer conference by the defense about the meaning of the instruction. At page 1167 of the appendix, the defense counsel agrees with plaintiff and stated that the proximate cause instruction contemplates what damage did he suffer as a result of the abuse. At page 1173, the defendant again agreed with plaintiff, stating, "Our case is that through the course of his life, he has been injured, but that is unrelated to what happened in 1962. On other pages of the jury prayer conference transcript, the defense seems confused by this issue. But Judge Scott proceeds and uses the Socratic method and ultimately gets the defense to admit that plaintiff's meaning is correct. And that is found at page A, 1173 to 1174, where Judge Scott concludes that the proximate cause question, in this case, under the facts of this case, focused on whether plaintiff's post-traumatic stress disorder, major depression, and other injuries were caused by the sexual abuse or were caused by other stressors in his life. Now, we also know this by looking at the verdict form found in the appendix of page A1567, where questions 1 and question 2 were, do you find the defendant, quote, liable under the CVA, under the Child Victims Act, excuse me. Now, liable means the quality or state of being legally obligated or responsible. And if the oblates in this case did not cause the abuse, if they were not responsible for the abuse, they would not be liable for damages. The jury instructions, page A1546, the first sentence states, plaintiff may recover against a legal entity if 4 specific elements are proven. May recover what? I would respectfully submit that means damages. Again, the proximate cause issue went to damages, not to liability, under the facts of this case, as Judge Scott crafted the instructions to suit so that the jury could address the issues that were truly in dispute in this case. Now, I believe that the totality of the record indicates and suggests that Judge Scott's position on the meaning of the proximate cause verdict and the meaning of the proximate cause instruction, that is consistent with plaintiff's position on appeal, that the issue goes to damages, whether Mr. Sheehan's damages were caused by the abuse or were caused by other stressors in his life. One of the main defense issues in this case, on appeal in this case, the defense seems to be arguing that proximate cause, that goes to whether the abuse was proximately caused by the oblate's gross negligence. Essentially, it's a superseding cause argument that the defense is making. Excuse me. The problem is that superseding cause was never raised at the trial court level. The defense never submitted a superseding cause instruction. The jury was never instructed on superseding cause. The defense never objected to the omission of a superseding cause instruction. And the term superseding cause was never mentioned in closing arguments by defense counsel. As a result, I believe that the record before Judge Scott was clear. The issue of proximate cause went to proximate cause of plaintiff's injuries, not proximate cause in the liability context. Now, to move on to the A versus the proximate cause issue, and I believe this issue is pretty well addressed in the briefing, so there's only a few issues that I would like to touch on unless the court has some questions. Excuse me. Proximate cause of plaintiff's injuries was the fundamental battle at trial. Once we got past liability and the issue of gross negligence and standard of care issues, what caused plaintiff's injuries was the focus at trial. And that is also the focus of two of plaintiff's primary arguments on appeal. The issue of the wording of the proximate cause special verdict form, which contradicted the jury instruction itself, but also the issue of the general causation expert and the exclusion of Dr. Langberg's testimony and only allowing in plaintiff's specific causation expert's testimony, Dr. Tavani. Now, under the standard of review, the jury instructions must give a correct statement of the law, and here the instructions did. But under the standard of review governing special verdict forms, they must not misdirect, mislead, or confuse. And I would submit to the court that is the lesson learned from the Culver v. Bennett decision this court has issued. When there is a material inconsistency between the jury instructions themselves and the special verdict form, that requires reversal because the jury doesn't know what to do. It causes confusion in the jury's mind. As the Florida appellate court stated in the Triple R paving case that I cite in our briefing, there is great potential for the jury to be misled into following the verdict form rather than the jury instructions. And I would submit to you the reason for that is because the verdict form is the last thing that the jury sees as it struggles to apply the law to the facts. When the form says the cause instead of a cause, and when the form says that and it contradicts what the instruction said in this case, that causes confusion. That causes significant confusion. And I would respectfully submit that's why we're here today, on plaintiff's direct appeal. The jury can't apply the law if it cannot understand the law. And in this case, it could not reconcile two contradictory statements of the law. The instructions stating that there can be more than one proximate cause, the jury verdict form saying the cause, suggesting only one cause. And under the facts of this case, plaintiff could not meet that burden. Plaintiffs admitted in closing argument that there were multiple causes of plaintiff's injuries, both the abuse and other traumas that he and his family suffered in their lives.
Was the interrogatory addressed in closing argument in some detail to any way explain?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Not in any great detail, Your Honor. I believe we went through it and said, check this box as we started to discuss the different issues. I believe plaintiff did argue a cause in closing argument. I believe we did argue that there could be multiple causes of plaintiff's injuries, the major depression and things of that nature.
So overall, the argument and the jury instructions were consistent. The only inconsistency is between the argument, the jury instructions, and the interrogatory.
Well, Your Honor, yes and no. As to the yes, we did argue that, and the instructions were proper. We fought for quite some time about the instructions at the prayer conference. It gets confusing on this issue of what did the instructions mean? What did the proximate cause instruction and ultimately the special verdict, what did that go to? Did it go to liability or did it go to damages? The defense in their closing argument, even though superseding cause was not an issue in the case, then there was no superseding cause instruction given, seems to be arguing superseding cause. So I think there is some confusion in that regard as to what it means. I believe Judge Scott was very clear on what he intended it to mean, and his meaning was consistent with that of plaintiff, that it went to proximate cause of plaintiff's injuries. The defense in closing, they never actually used the term superseding cause, but upon reflection, upon reading the actual dry transcript, it appears that is what they were arguing, even though it was not flagged as an issue in the case. So I think some confusion does arise from that, Your Honor. On the issue of plaintiff's general causation expert, I believe the issues of general and specific causation really aren't contested on this appeal. I believe it becomes more of an issue of whether or not it was necessary in this case. And unless the court has a question about that, I believe that issue is adequately covered in the briefing, and I don't think I can say it better than it was said there.
Right.
On the issue of intentional, on the issue of whether the Child Victims Act also revives intentional torts, again, I believe this was adequately addressed in the briefing, but there is one issue I do need to bring to the court's attention. Previously, only Judge Vaughn and Judge Silverman had ruled that intentional torts were, in fact, revived. About a month and a half ago, Judge Vaughn reversed his ruling and said, to be consistent with Judge Scott's ruling in this case, he was going to rule that intentional torts were not revived by the act. So I just believe I do need to bring that to the court's attention. On the issue of which version of the Delaware Code applies under the Child Victims Act of 2007, and I believe this is a fundamental issue, the act did not create a new cause of action. Plaintiff could have sued Salesianum and the Oblates of St. Francis de Sales in negligence in 1962 had he been able to. A cause of action in negligence existed back in the 60s. The act did not create a new cause of action. All the act did was revive the remedy. Plaintiff's right to sue in negligence has always existed, even when the statute of limitations ran in 1964 after 2 years passed. That has always existed. He could have always done that, but it was his remedy that was lost when the statute expired. All the act did was revive that time-barred remedy. It restored his ability to get a remedy, to receive a remedy. But no new cause of action was created. And because no new cause of action was created, there is no ex post facto concern. There is no due process concern. It's just about the remedy. And I believe that the legislative intent, that the intent of the General Assembly was clear as to which statutes it was attempting to create which statutes it was using to identify the type of conduct which was to receive the revived remedy. Senate Attorney Jeff Clark listed 7 specific offenses in his testimony before the General Assembly. Senator Still said, I want these questions out there on the record so that it is clear, so that when a judge has to come back and look at this history, that there are no questions. And Senate Attorney Jeffrey Clark identified 7 specific offenses. I think that is why the current version of the code applies. Plaintiffs under the act do not have to prove that a crime occurred. I believe the intention of the legislature was to identify the type of conduct which was to receive the revived remedy. I believe that was the extent of what the General Assembly was trying to do. I don't believe that this was a criminal trial masquerading as a civil trial, as Judge Scott had suggested during the prayer conference. Unless the court has any questions about the Rule 404B evidence issues, I believe I've covered that in the briefing.
Right.
Now on to the facial due process. I think the standard of review here is very important. This statute enacted by the General Assembly, it receives a strong presumption of constitutionality, and all doubts are to be resolved in favor of constitutionality. Courts give great deference to the legislature in enacting public policy, and that is what the Child Victims Act was. Now, for more than 50 years, state due process has followed federal due process. That would be state due process under Section 7 as well as under Section 9 of the Delaware State Constitution of 1897. As this court has held in the Cheswold opinion in 1985, the terms due course of law and law of the land are analogous to the term due process of law in the 14th Amendment. Analogous to has been used, this court has used the term coextensive with, substantially the same meaning as, is to be interpreted in the same manner. All of those words have been used. State due process respectfully tracks federal due process. Not all state constitutional issues do, but in the due process context, the law of the land provision, it does. This court has been consistent on this going back to the General Electric opinion in 1954. In light of that, it was no surprise that in Justice Holland's treatise that he does state that it has been general, that the two provisions have been generally held to have the same meaning. But these due process holdings have occurred in all different contexts, from sex offender registration to probation revocation to public employee discipline to securities issues. They have been procedural due process cases. They have been substantive due process cases. But all across the board, this court has consistently held for over 50 years that state due process tracks federal due process. And under federal law, it's been clear since at least 1885 that the revival of time-barred civil remedies does not violate the federal Constitution, the 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clause. The court first held that in Campbell v. Holt in 1885, continuing into Chase Securities in 1945. It's held that in the 1970s in the International Union opinion dealing with Title VII cases. It has held that as recently as 1995 in the Plout v. Spendthrift opinions. Federal law is clear. It has been clear for a long time. State law tracks federal law on this issue. Accordingly, there is no constitutional violation. But just putting aside federal law, under pure Delaware law, the Act can apply retroactively because statutes of limitations only affect matters, only go to matters of procedure and to matters of remedy. In the Hubbard case from this court in 1993, this court held that remedial statutes that affect procedure or remedies may apply retroactively. In the Cheswold opinion, again from 1985, this court held, quote, "We elaborate at the risk of repetition. A statute of limitations is a procedural mechanism which nullifies the remedy alone." That's different than statutes of repose, which the court also held is a substantive provision, unlike a statute of limitations. Such a substantive provision nullifies both the remedy and the right. Cheswold teaches us that a statute of limitations is only a matter of procedure and it only nullifies a remedy. It doesn't eliminate the right the way that a statute of repose does. Because it's procedural, because it only affects a remedy, it can be retroactively applied. I would note that the defense brief is very light on Delaware law on this issue. And I would submit that the reason for that is there's no Delaware law to contradict this. Delaware law says this is permissible, and the General Assembly did that. It acted well within well-established Delaware law. Now, the primary defense argument on constitutionality appears to be this vested rights issue. And I would submit that because state due process tracks federal due process and because of the clarity of the law on the procedure and remedy issue, that this court does not need to reach the vested rights issue. It's unnecessary to resolve this case. But if the court does want to, if the court does feel that it needs to address this issue, I would submit that more analysis needs to go into this than just the magic incantation of the term vested right. Vested right is not a holy grail. Throwing the term vested right out there doesn't mean that they can't be touched. This court has touched vested rights before and held that vested rights can be touched, can be affected without violating due process. In the Price v. All-American Engineering case, 320 Atlantic 2nd, 336, the Delaware Supreme Court, 1974, this court held that vested rights may be retroactively taken away without violating due process if the statute at issue is a valid exercise of the police power intended to protect the health and the safety of the people of Delaware. So even if this court does feel the need to reach the vested rights issue, I would submit vested rights, that's not the end of the equation. Vested rights can be touched. Some states hold differently. Delaware has addressed this issue. There's not a lot of law in Delaware on vested rights, but there is this Supreme Court opinion from the 1970s saying that touching vested rights does not violate due process. I would also note that Judge Biferrato of the Superior Court also had an opinion called In re Campbell, which addressed some of these issues. That case is dated July 18th of 1986, touching on some of these same issues about how the general power of the state to get involved in these issues as a means of protecting the health and safety of its citizens, that can be done. That is a basic power of the state, and that doing so does not necessarily violate due process. I would also submit that our General Assembly has a rich history of stepping up to the plate and trying to help injured persons who the statute of limitations would otherwise fail. There's the Agent Orange precedent, where the General Assembly enacted the special 6-month window in the early 80s. There's also the current health care window, which was recently enacted this summer. The General Assembly could do this because for so many years, for 54 years at least, state due process has tracked federal due process. And statutes of limitations only address matters of remedy and matters of procedure. I don't believe that there's any reason the court even needs to look outside of Delaware because of the clarity of Delaware law on this issue. Now, there's also the due course of law issue, which is in Article 1, Section 9. Now, as I set forth in my motion to strike that was filed after the defense reply brief was filed, this argument has been waived. It was never raised below, where the defense consistently only argued the law of the land provision. It was not raised in the defendant's opening brief on appeal here, where it stated, quote, in summary, the oblate's view is this. Under Delaware's law of the land, vested rights cannot be disturbed by the legislature. That's the defense opening brief at page 63 here on appeal. Now, that issue has been raised in the Superior Court before by various public school defendants, in some cases under the Child Victims Act. But the Superior Court has never reached a decision on that issue. As Judge Witham held in the Byers decision, which I also cited in my brief, this due course of law issue has never before been addressed. However, all those cases were stayed pending the outcome of this appeal because the defendants in those cases had, I think there were four or five cases which actually got stayed because of that Byers opinion. The defendants in those cases suggested to the Superior Court that this court's decision would give the Superior Court some guidance on how to address such con law issues.
Mr. Neuberger, in order to be fair, you've used up half of your rebuttal already. Did you want to continue, or did you want to save some time?
I believe I saved 7 minutes for my ultimate rebuttal.
You did, but you now use 3.5 minutes of it.
In that case, I will step down. Thank you, Your Honor.
I didn't want it to slip by and let you. I wanted to make sure you could decide one way or another on it.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon. On the issue of the special verdict form, the standard of review is plain error. And in this case, plain error does not exist and is not evidenced in such a manner as this court should overturn the findings of the jury in this case. The findings of the jury were clearly supported by the factual evidence that came into the record, by the arguments, and through the jury instructions. Part of the problem in this case was the statutory construction of Section 8145. Section 8145 did not incorporate a proximate cause provision into the statute. What they did was set out a series of burdens that a plaintiff had to meet in order to bring a claim under the statute. And what those included were an act of abuse that constituted a crime under the Delaware Code, employment of the perpetrator by the institutional defendant against whom the claim was being brought, or in the case where an employment relationship wasn't established, the engagement of the perpetrator in some act that was supervised or controlled by the institutional defendant, a duty of care by the institutional defendant to the alleged victim, and a finding of gross negligence. 8145 does not include any provision relative to proximate cause. But in Delaware law, a tort involving gross negligence requires the jury to make an additional finding of proximate cause before they can assess damages. In this case, the plaintiffs presented two theories against the Oblates of St. Francis de Sales and Salesianum. They presented one theory that alleged that the Oblates and Salesianum knew that Frank Norris was a sexual predator, and they ignored that fact and placed him into a classroom, putting children in danger of sexual abuse. But they argued a second theory, and the second theory that they argued was that the Oblates didn't know that he posed a danger of sexual abuse, but were aware of red flags in his past, including alcoholism and depression, and that those red flags should have prohibited them from placing Frank Norris in a classroom because he presented a danger to the students. Well, it was at trial and continues to be the Oblates and Salesianum's position that they cannot be found liable under Section 8145 if they act in a gross manner which is not proximately related to an act of sexual abuse. That cannot have been the intention of 8145. It was designed to address sexual abuse acts that occurred in the past.
I'm not sure where this argument's going. Was the jury verdict form Part 3 correct or not?
It was. It absolutely was.
Then the instructions were not correct?
The instructions were correct as well, Your Honor.
They were inconsistent.
Well, they weren't necessarily inconsistent.
Well, one was an A and the other was a B.
That is true. But I think that the argument that the appellants, plaintiffs, have put on the is putting too much emphasis on the versus a. Every time the plaintiffs have argued about the special verdict form and the inconsistency, they attach another word. They say the sole cause of the damages. And in fact, sole was not included in the special verdict form at all. It just said the proximate cause. And so if you read, and when you're analyzing on a plain error standard, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, the totality of the instructions.
Well, I thought the argument was, while we as attorneys might instantly grasp the significance of the proximate cause as opposed to a proximate cause, the danger of having a jury instruction inconsistent with a verdict form is that the jury won't instantly grasp the significance of that potential difference and be able to reconcile the two in a way that's entirely consistent with the instructions and even the argument made to the jury. That's what I took the argument to be. Not necessarily that the jury had to read the words the proximate cause as the sole proximate cause, but that since we don't know what goes on in a jury room, it's necessary to make the instructions clear and any jury verdict form entirely consistent with the instructions because of the danger of jury confusion.
Well, I think that reads too much into the distinguishing between the and on the special verdict form. When you look at the jury instructions as a whole, and every single case cited.
Well, see, my concern is, you understand that. I think even I understand that. But the issue here isn't what we think after the fact. The issue is, did this at least superficial to us inconsistency run the risk that the jury was confused and got the law wrong?
I think when the court looks at the totality of the instructions and all of the case law indicates the importance of looking at the entirety of the instructions to determine whether there was the potential for confusion. And in this case, the totality of the instructions together with the arguments should eliminate any possibility, any fear that the jury was confused in the manner that the plaintiffs are suggesting.
Well, aren't the juries still told? It's been a few years since I performed during a jury trial, but isn't the jury still told that to the extent the argument's inconsistent with the instruction, they are to ignore what the lawyers say and follow the instructions given by the court?
They are.
So how does the argument help here?
Well, I think because not only was the jury instructed at the request of plaintiffs properly on proximate cause, but also the additional instruction that there can be multiple potential causes, multiple proximate causes of an injury. And they stressed that at length in their closing argument. So the fact that they were properly instructed on proximate cause, the fact that they were additionally cautioned and instructed on the fact that there can be multiple potential proximate causes for an injury, the fact that the plaintiffs hammered in on that fact in their closing argument eliminates the possibility that the jury would place significance on the word the as opposed to the word in the special verdict form. I think that's really the important part here. I would also mention that the jury deliberated for over 9 hours and had two very thoughtful questions that suggested that they were, as instructed, looking at the jury instructions as a whole, and the questions did not relate to any inconsistency between the verdict form. They didn't relate to proximate cause at all. The questions that they raised had to do with the relationship between Salesianum and the oblates and with regard to the definition of gross negligence. So this was a thoughtful jury who was taking into and considering the jury instructions that were provided to them, and their questions evidenced that they may have had some confusion with regard to the definition of gross negligence, but that they had no confusion at all with regard to the definition of proximate cause or its relationship to the events in this case.
Which side prepared and submitted the verdict form?
The court did. We each submitted one, and the trial judge submitted his own, and the verdict form of the trial judge was the one that was provided to the jury in this case. And the plaintiffs wrapped the argument regarding Dr. Langberg, the psychologist who was going to talk about general damages, into this argument regarding proximate cause, and I would just submit to the court that that's a very different argument. The standard on an evidentiary question with regard to the admissibility of an expert is abuse of discretion, and the trial court did not abuse its discretion in prohibiting Dr. Langberg from testifying. Dr. Langberg had never examined Mr. Sheehan and was not being produced and did not intend to offer any specific opinions relative to Mr. Sheehan's injuries, but was going to be offering generalized damage testimony as to what victims of sexual abuse may suffer. And the trial judge exercised discretion to exclude that when there was a psychiatrist who had, in fact,
at the urging of defendant's counsel, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And the counsel for the defendants who were urging were the same defendants' counsel who were defending in the Vi case. Is that right?
That is true.
And in the Vi case, Dr. Lindberg did testify.
Well, Dr. Langberg did testify, but Judge Vaughn made a very specific ruling that was not inconsistent with Judge Scott's ruling in the Sheehan case. What the trial judge in the Vi case did was say that Dr. Langberg would be entitled to offer case-specific observations because she had not personally examined Mr. Vi, but she had reviewed his psychiatric records and she had had a lengthy phone conversation with him. So she was distinguishable from Sheehan, able to offer case-specific testimony regarding the damages of Mr. Vi that she was unable to do so in regard to the damages of Mr. Sheehan, and that was the distinction, and the judge in the Vi case was cognizant of that distinction and made a ruling that would not be inconsistent with the ruling in the Sheehan trial.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. It's an honor, actually, to be here to present this case of first impression to this court. I'd spend my time focused on 2 points. Number one, the legislature lacks the constitutional power to revive lapsed civil damage actions under Article 1, Section 9. Therefore, Section 8145 is unconstitutional under the state's constitution. And number two, even if the legislature had the constitutional power to act, Section 8145 could not constitutionally be applied to the oblates. They were prejudiced and harmed by having to defend against an ancient claim on which they had no notice. So in these circumstances, even if the legislature had the power to act, this law could not constitutionally be applied to the oblates. To the first point, From 1792 to the present, the legislative power in this state is cabined under the doctrine of vested rights. It's not a holy grail, but it was certainly important to the people who wrote and voted for and believed in the Constitution that was enacted in 1792. The legislature could not invade vested rights. This is a statement which appears over and over in the jurisprudence of this court and the courts of this state, Gallagher, Hazard, Diamond State, Iron, and a number of other cases. These cases don't involve balancing or strict scrutiny or anything else. They're simply cases that state, as a matter of Delaware law, that where a vested right is impaired, the legislature may not tread. I think that in terms of constitutional theory, it's important to note the reserve clause, because the reserve clause at the end of Article I, as the court knows, withdraws these powers, including the Article I, Section 9 power, from the authority, the general authority of the government, including the legislature. Among the rights considered vested by common law scholars, by the people who wrote and voted for the Constitution, and by the judges in the intervening years, was a legal exemption from the demand of another. This is a definition of vested rights that appears in the case law of the state. It's attributed to Judge Cooley, who wrote an important treatise on constitutional limitations in the 19th century. It's attributed also to Professor Sutherland, who wrote the treatise on statutory construction. In fact, there are a number of other treatises that all date to the same period of time, around the time when the Constitution was reenacted in 1897. All of them say, without exception, that where the time has fully run on a claim, that creates a vested right in the putative defendant, and that defendant is now legally exempt from the demand of another, and that it is beyond the power of the legislature to alter in any material way.
Well, are you suggesting the General Assembly wasted its time when it enacted a statute of repose as was in Lambertson?
No, I think that the statutes of repose are aimed at different problems. The statute of repose, I think, cut off all claims, including any tolling arrangement. The statute of limitations, as an affirmative defense, as you know, can be waived, but could also be told if there is some, if the cause of the complaint is inherently unknowable, or there's some active fraud. So, there is built into the notion of statutes of limitations this sort of tolling idea that has worked in the intervening years, some requisite balance between the rights of litigants. But the statute of repose, as a specific thing, cuts off these claims, and it's jurisdictional, as the court said at the tail end of Cheswold. But there's no clear holding, that in Cheswold, this is actually at the end, as the court knows, there's this extra discussion about whether that defense was waived or not. But it's clear that the legislature has the power under certain circumstances to do that. But still, there is a fair opportunity for litigation for prospective plaintiffs. But as other states have ruled, if the legislature can alter the statutes of limitations once the matter is fully run, then the protection of these statutes are meaningless. No one can rely with certainty on them. And the majority view, as we lay out in our brief, in sister states for purposes of horizontal federalism, where the question is specifically presented, does the Constitution of this state bar revival of a claim by the legislature once the time has run? 26 of those states say that the state constitution may not, including the five of them whose language is closest to Delaware's. I think that the court need not and should not rely on the federal cases under federal due process. First of all, in the intervening 50 years, the constitutional jurisprudence of this court, as you know, better than anybody else in the room knows, has changed. The way that you look at the state constitution is different. There's a whole body of dual sovereignty that is part of the substantive law of the state. And again, in a certain respect, I think it inverts the relationship between state and federal constitutional law. For the 75 years until the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868, the state constitution was the only source of rights for the citizens. In the intervening 200 years, the state's constitutions, including the constitution of this state, provides rights that are unavailable. Vested rights is a concept which is unknown to the federal law. It is not part of the federal law. And as the Supreme Court of the United States said in Cruzan, a case which this court cites in Dorsey, the common law exists to empower the states to do things that the federal government may not do. And as we lay out in the brief, the text, the purposes, the history, the boundaries, and for these purposes, horizontal federalism, all, you know, would encourage you to the result that the legislature lacked the power to act. On the as-applied challenge, the oblates here had no reasonable expectation that they would be sued over ancient claims. There is nothing in the legal history of the state that would have put this defendant on notice that it could be held accountable for something that it did not know about, it had no reason to suspect, and had no reason to plan for that happened 47 years ago, almost 50 years ago. The mandate of Article 1, Section 9, as the court knows, is to administer justice without unreasonable delay. There was no such justice here. These claims were brought forward for the first time to the oblates in and after 2007. And that the trial of this case made them respond to these ancient claims without notice and without an opportunity, without witnesses, without records, without really anything that they could do to try to, in effect, prove a negative that Father Norris, of whom they had no information, was not an offender. In a sense, as we lay out in the brief, we're asking a jury in 2009 to look back at things that happened in 1962 and try to figure out whether that defendant acted reasonably. But it didn't apply 1962 standards. It applied contemporary attitudes. And the world is different now. The term pedophilia was unknown. Child abuse was not even a reportable offense until the 1960s. Until the 1970s, sexual abuse of a child. It's not that the world was better or simpler or more congenial then. There are a lot of things that through course of law and through the course of time we've addressed. But this is a situation where in 1962, Father Norris was given ministry and he was given the opportunity to teach in the school. There was nothing that shows up in the records of the oblates from a personnel perspective or anything else that would put them on notice as to sexual abuse, as to why Father Norris should not have been allowed in that classroom. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal, if that's okay, unless the court has questions at this point.
I think that you have 5 minutes, and you've got 6 minutes and 20 seconds left. All right.
I would reserve the balance if that's okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, on this issue of that the oblates on the as-applied challenge only knew about Father Norris in 2007. Simply put, I believe that ignores the factual standard of review arising from the jury verdict in plaintiff's favor. I spent a lot of time on that in the brief. Unless the court has a further question about that, I'll move on to the next topic. But it ignores the factual standard of review. Plaintiff won on that. These issues about code words and what the documents really meant and things of that nature. These are issues the defense did not appeal. They're issues the plaintiff won on. Now, to go back to this vested rights issue, one of the cases that Mr. Chopko cited was the Hazard opinion, the Delaware Superior Court opinion from 1934. Hazard says that a vested right is something more than a mere expectation based upon an anticipated continuance of the existing law. And it goes on in that opinion and states, no one has a vested right in a public law, but the legislature may repeal or amend all legislative acts, not in the nature of contracts or private grants. Well, statute of limitations is not a contract, and it's certainly not a private grant. It's using the language of Hazard, a statute of limitations is merely a public law. It's a creature of the legislature that the legislature can give and the legislature can take away. Now, moving on to this issue about the argument about the entire text of Article 1, Section 9, I believe that issue has been waived. The defense only argued law of the land in their opening brief, and they only argued law of the land, the law of the land provision. They didn't argue due course of law. They didn't argue the entirety of the remedies clause. Those issues have not been briefed. They have never been briefed, except in the defendant's reply brief here on appeal. I would note that this due course of law issue, This court has addressed the meaning of due course of law in the Cheswold opinion, saying it's analogous to the term due process of law. And the earliest opinion I found addressing that issue was actually a Chancery Court opinion from 1884, which states due process of law and due course of law mean the same thing. That's the Wilson v. Baltimore and Philadelphia Railroad Company opinion, 5 Delaware Chancery 524. Moving on to this reasonable reliance issue on the as-applied challenge, just briefly, as my brief states, the defendants cannot have reasonably relied upon the prior statute of limitations when the law has been clear in Delaware since the 1950s that a statute of limitations can change at any time because it is a creature of the legislature, because it's procedural, because it goes to matters of remedy, and because state due process tracks federal due process. Now, in conclusion, our General Assembly made a considered policy decision to respond to the longstanding widespread problem of childhood sexual abuse by reviving a remedy and giving a voice to children that were silenced for so many years. They were silenced out of fear. They were silenced out of shame. But the General Assembly decided to give those children a voice. I would ask you not to take that voice away. Thank you.
Now, was your rebuttal intended to address the cross appeal?
My rebuttal is limited to the two constitutional issues, facial and as applied.
All right.
And the additional comments here. It's clear that the definition of vested right is something which goes to the heart of the case. And the case law that both sides have briefed extensively traces its course into the early 19th century into the decisions of the court. There's a definition that appears in the Bailey case in 1846. It talks about the power to take certain actions or possess certain things according to the laws of the land. But it's clear that this court has never departed from that as a benchmark and as a limitation on the power of the legislature to act. That's the first point that I would make. Secondly, you're looking at the construction of Article 1, Section 9, all of it. I don't think that there's any mistake about that, both in the trial court and in the opening brief. We opened by restating the text of Article 1, Section 9. We, in response to the briefing on federal due process and the briefing about balancing of rights and equities, we got into the questions of reserve power and separation of powers and so on. Both sides raise cases that deal with due course of law because it's raised in sister state adjudications. And if you look at Pennsylvania, from which the Delaware Constitution, at least in Article 1, was drawn extensively, Pennsylvania jurisprudence turns, I think, almost exclusively on the construction of due course of law. It's not clear that, to me, as you know, having read the cases, that is necessarily the way that this court would come out. But you know, we raise this because it is a case of first impression, and what you do will guide not just the legislature in the future, but litigants and the expectations of courts and so on. I don't think it's fair to say that everybody was on notice that the statute of limitations would change from 1954 because we're following the federal rule. Klein actually says, which is the 1954 case, we generally look to the federal jurisprudence unless there's a good reason not to. And we've given you plenty of good reason why you shouldn't. And the other thing which strikes me about the cases where this has come up is that it's almost exclusively dicta. And no one has challenged the power of the legislature to act. They're basically focused at the legislature's rationale. That was the point in Klein. In Klein, there were two Supreme Court decisions on point, and sister states, 16 sister states, had adjudicated the issue, and it had been a legislative issue for decades in the state legislatures as well as in the Congress. So, again, no one had raised this point. And that's why I think, again, we come back to the idea that this is a case of first impression. Nobody has, in our study, has raised the direct question that we do. Did the legislature have the power to act? We don't think that it had the power to act under the doctrine of vested rights. With respect to the prejudice that we suffered, there was, as I've said before, there's no notice, there were no records, there were no witnesses. They expended time and resources in defending these ancient claims. They asked the trial court by filing a motion for summary judgment, please, Judge, rule that this law cannot constitutionally be applied to us. The judge overruled that motion and let the matter go to trial, where they expended time, resources, adverse publicity, and everything else. And in the end, they were found to have violated Section 8145. On testimony that was laced with code words and suspicion and certain nuances that the jury was allowed to speculate about. There was nothing that happened in the four corners of the actual trial that would focus the jury and ask them to say, what would you do if you were a juror in 1962? There was some attention paid to that in opening and closing, but very little in between. So for all of those reasons, I don't think that this could constitutionally be applied to the oblates in these circumstances. May I conclude?
Yes.
The sexual abuse of children is a heinous crime, and it's a grievous sin. And both church and state condemn it, and rightly so. Those who abuse should be brought to justice. Those who allowed it should be held accountable, and those who suffer should be brought to healing. But all of this has to be done according to the rule of law and constitutional principle. One of those rules is that the statute of limitations, which settles rights, defenses, and expectations, when that is run, it creates a substantive right, a vested right, in a defendant against the prosecution of these ancient claims. The oblates are well aware of their responsibility to those who suffered abuse in our institutions, and we affirmatively today take steps at healing and reconciliation, as we have for many years. But Section 8145 is not a step in those directions. It promotes litigation. It does not promote healing and reconciliation. It is unconstitutional, we submit, and this Court should declare it so.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.